The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
How y'all doing?
Good.
All right. Okay, so today I want to talk about a side of Martin Luther King Jr. that's often forgotten or what's typical buried. I think without knowing this more radical side of King that I'm going to talk about, we're often left with a whitewash, kind of like the good Negro image of a responsible king who advocated for racial inequality in the South and the South only. Instead, I want to discuss today a king who struggled against racism from below, both below and above the Mason-Dixon line, who fought racism reproduced by both Jim Crow laws and the economic laws of capitalism, and who denounced racism perpetrated by the U.S. elite both across state borders and international borders. In short, I want to correct the image of King, because I think we're living in a time where the demand that Black Lives Matter rings loud, but questions remain about how to make this demand a reality, about who should make them matter and how. And King, I want to argue, can point us in the right direction if we look at him in his totality. I believe focusing our attention on the last year of King's life, from April 3rd, 1967 to April 4th, 1968, I think this will show us what commitments and vision a movement for racial justice today needs. So the first thing I want to argue, just so it's clear, is that King was always a militant whose strategy since the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 had been to use mass action, that is the involvement of people themselves, to disrupt the system so as to raise the social costs of the ruling class to continue running the things the old way, and therefore to compel it to accept the demands of the movement. The strategy of mass disruption itself was actually a shift from the old post-war civil rights strategy led by the NAACP to fight racial inequality in the courts rather than in the streets. So when King appeared on the scene in 1955, he and his organization, which was founded later, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, marked a radical break with the legalism of the movement before it. The second thing I want to try to argue is that King himself did shift politically throughout his life. In the last year of his life, he came out against the war in Vietnam. He sought to create a national multiracial campaign for economic justice called the Poor People's Campaign, and his life was ended while supporting a months-long strike of 1,300 public sector workers in Memphis, Tennessee. And he did all of this with opposition from the White House, former allies among white liberals and other civil rights leaders, including his own colleagues in the SCLC. King's long-standing commitment to civil rights caused him to strategically break with the previous civil rights strategy that may have worked to fight Jim Crow racism locally, but would certainly fail if used to fight against capitalist racism nationwide. And so the last thing I want to try to argue today is that we need this corrected version of King to help us answer questions, key questions about how to re-energize and broaden the Black Lives Matter movement today. King grappled with questions that I think we're also still grappling with about how a black freedom movement should relate to elections, the Democratic Party, and to labor. In many ways, we should look to King, I think, as an example of how to respond to these really difficult questions. In 1967, like I was saying, King went against the grain. This wasn't a popular thing to do. He went against the grain and condemned the war in Vietnam, which effectively broke his reliance, with the Democratic Party leadership. Today, former leaders of Black Lives Matter are running as Democrats or founding NGOs that ask people to wait until November, for example. And I think what King shows us is that we need to instead remain committed to internationalism and mass action above anything else. And furthermore, what he shows us is that black workers' lives matter, and that the movement of racial justice must eventually take up economic demands and organize black workers in the workplace. Black workers, like everyone else in the working class, leverage the most power in the workplace at the site of production, and it is these workers, together with allies, who will become even more important to today, I think, especially with the recent Janus decision, which will gut public sector unions. This will mean that people of color will disproportionately be affected in a double sense, since they're both employed and rely on social services at higher rates than other social groups. More states, I think, will start passing right-to-work laws, which King actually had something to say about this. He said, you know, don't be tricked by this. Right-to-work provides no rights and no work. He said, more broadly, in our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right-to-work. It is a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions for everyone. Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights. So, I think we're, cross your fingers, embarking on an era where I'll call it civil rights unionism will need to play a central part in creating a movement that will fight back against the attacks on all working people, especially black people, and for politically training a leadership among those people to extend the movement. And I believe we have a lot to learn from King in this respect. So let me continue in talking about his last year. On April 3rd, 1967, a year and a day before his death, Martin Luther King Jr. condemned the war in Vietnam. In truth, he had always been opposed to the war and had even criticized it to a Los Angeles audience 2 months prior. In February, again 2 months before his famous April Beyond Vietnam speech, he urged people to see the connection between the war at home and abroad. He said, "A casualty of the war in Vietnam is the Great Society," which was Lyndon B. Johnson's kind of welfare program proposal. "The confused war has played havoc with our domestic destinies. Despite feeble protestations to the contrary, the promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam. The pursuit of this widened war has narrowed domestic welfare programs, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens, both at the front and at home." In his famous Beyond Vietnam speech in New York, which is where I'm from, he went further and condemned the system that produced the war. He wrote, "I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." So, for his actions, King was predictably condemned by liberal elites and other civil rights leaders. His own colleagues, in a move which would become a theme throughout the last year of his life, his own colleagues pressured King into moderation, pleading that he not condemn the war in Vietnam. Civil rights leaders in the Urban League and the National NAACP leadership condemned him for conflating anti-war demands for civil rights. So did newspapers like liberal ones like the Washington Post and the New York Times. I think one weakness of King's style of organization was that it was staffed. It wasn't like a mass democratic membership organization. So the SCLC had to, as a result, rely on contributions from liberal foundations. So when he came out against the war, the SCLC's budget was actually cut considerably, creating a crisis in the SCLC and I think in the broader civil rights movement. It's a testament to King's commitment, though, that he knew about this risk, but made the decision anyway to come out against the war. In a speech later that year to an audience of 500 dissident anti-war unionists, King said, "One civil rights leader spoke to me one day and said, 'Now, Dr. King, don't you think you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy? I understand that your position on Vietnam has hurt the budget of your organization. And many people who respected you in civil rights have lost that respect. And don't you think that you're going to have to agree more with the administration's policy to regain this?' And I had to answer," said King. "I had to answer by looking that person into the eye and say, 'I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I do not determine what is right and wrong by looking at the budget of my organization or by taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a molder of consensus," something to keep in mind for today. For this speech, King had a falling out with officials of the labor movement, causing him to attempt to relate more to the small militant wing that could be found. By the 60s, the labor movement was, I'm going to because I always do this, rant and complain about the labor movement. By the 1960s, the labor movement was very top-down, and labor bureaucrats actually tolerated racism and endorsed the imperialist wars of the government. For example, the president of the AFL-CIO of the time, George Meany, had opposed King's demand to expel segregated locals. The degeneration of the labor movement, which was a long process, it was occurring since the 30s, this degeneration required the attack and expulsion of militant and anti-racist unionists, a project carried out by the right wing of the labor movement of the 40s with bipartisan support. The labor movement of the 30s and 40s really was, I'm going to argue, was the first civil rights movement. It had organized 500,000 black people, many of them into interracial locals that would fight not just for better wages, but against entire ruling elites for protections inside and outside the workplace, which meant also attacking Jim Crow laws. Thousands of black and white workers became trained as organizers and activists, and together, unfortunately, they were targeted in the post-war Red Scare era. All this meant was that the civil rights movement had to, in a sense, restart in the mid-1950s, and did so on a more conservative basis in a political climate where activism and preaching social equality could bring you charges of communism and even criminal charges. And so King and the struggles during the Black Power movement had very little support from a now conservatized labor movement where, you know, this is labor. There's this tremendous social power concentrated here, but it was held inactive by the inaction and conservatism of labor bureaucrats. So the labor movement had the power to end, if not prevent, the war in Vietnam by calling for a general strike, for example, but instead it supported it. The labor movement should have supported King when he broke with Vietnam, but only a tiny section of rank and filers would. So if labor bureaucrats didn't get the connection between the war and labor at home, King certainly did understand the war and how it affected unions. And because it affected labor, it would affect all workers. For example, in this meeting I mentioned earlier with this militant labor audience, King had said, Now, what are some of the domestic consequences of the war in Vietnam? It has made the Great Society a myth and replaced it with a troubled and confused society. The war has strengthened domestic reaction. It has given the extreme right, the anti-labor, anti-Negro, and anti-humanistic, funny how all those are together, right? Forces a weapon of spurious patriotism to galvanize its supporters into reaching for power right up to the White House. He noted the central importance of labor here, where while millions were condemning the war, King said, one voice was missing, the loud, clear voice of labor. The absence of that one voice was all the more tragic, because it may be the decisive one for tipping the balance toward peace. So in the last year of his life, we clearly see a King who is through and through intersectional. In his words and in his deeds, we see him make connections between the oppression of blacks and whites and Vietnamese, the underlying interests of Southern and Northern Democrats to carry out oppression domestically and internationally, and the overlap between labor rights and civil rights. The Vietnam War, like all wars in the 20th century, was created by a Democrat. So the civil rights movement had been quiet about criticizing the war, even in the early 60s while JFK was funding and training the anti-communists in South Vietnam. It remained silent because the movement's strategy was to use the federal government to try to break the power of the Jim Crow elite in the South. It saw the federal government, including the Democratic Party, as an ally, even if it was a reluctant one. King himself called for a moratorium on protests so as not to risk the election of President Lyndon B. Johnson in 1964. So this reliance on the Democratic Party, if it were ever tenable, would certainly not be sustainable in the post-Jim Crow era, which is today, where the cost for housing and unions and schools would be too much for mayors, governors, and presidents to bear, much more costly than the more affordable demands of the years previous, like the right to vote and integrated facilities. These were considered cheaper, right, from a ruling class perspective, and affordable if there was enough noise. So furthermore, as more civil rights leaders like Bayard Rustin entered the Democratic Party, they helped delegitimize and isolate the more militant section of the movement that was required, I think, to achieve black freedom. So to continue the struggle in the late 60s, it's very hard to do. To continue the struggle, the king had a choice. He could become an establishment leader like John Lewis and achieve nothing but a secure livelihood. Or he can help expand the civil rights movement into an interracial militant mass movement. Knowing the risk to his life, he chose the latter. And so his next project would become the Poor People's Campaign. So let me talk a little bit about 1968, because it was a crazy year. By 1968, so I hear. By 1968, in many ways, it seems like things were, in many ways, I mean, there were, you know, glimmers of hope and inspiring things like in Paris. But in many ways, it seemed like things were getting worse. Hundreds of thousands of young people had been drafted to Vietnam. In January, the Viet Cong would launch the Tet Offensive, causing a major setback for the Americans. President Johnson, as a result, would increase the total amount of troops to over 500,000, while tens of thousands of black and white young people were being returned to their poor families in body bags from Indochina. Many more were beginning to wonder if maybe this war was a mistake. Black rebellions had flared across major U.S. cities every summer since 1964. Laws outlawing segregation and voter repression seemed to have done little to address the poverty and despair of millions of black people, hence the appeal of black power. 14 years after the Brown decision, we're talking here, and 4 years after the Civil Rights Act, the Kerner Commission could report that, quote, our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. Moving toward two societies? Like, I thought we ended that in the early 60s. No, things are getting worse in a lot of ways. So clearly the movement had much more work to do. But this was easier said than done. Many would not know how the movement should continue. Many who entered the Black Power and anti-war movements would very soon find themselves victims of factionalism or state repression, very demoralizing experience. In February of 1968, black students in South Carolina tried to integrate a bowling alley. And this is like a la late 50s, right? Like style. They were gunned down by state troopers who would later be acquitted of all charges of shooting three teenagers in the back. This was becoming a moment of white backlash and right-wing resurgence, hence Nixon. So, and the very popular George Wallace campaign of that year. Clearly, 1968 needed a nationwide campaign to end the wars at home and abroad. And King attempted to provide a solution. He launched the Poor People's Campaign as an effort to give organization and unity and direction to the sense of despair. He envisioned the campaign would call for the end to the war, use those funds, and compel Congress to pass an economic bill of rights that would provide subsidized housing, full employment, a living wage, a guaranteed income for the unemployed, all things we don't have yet. This campaign marked a shift of what King called phase two of the civil rights movement. This marks a shift in several ways. The issues concern not just the South, but the entirety of the country. DC would be compelled to put its money where its mouth was, so to speak, and fund programs for economic equality that many believed Johnson's Great Society would deliver. Also, unlike the march on Washington in 1963, King envisioned that the Poor People's Campaign would march to DC and occupy the city, disrupt business as usual, and even block the roads until these programs were created. Yet King could count on few allies to help him, tragically. His longtime ally, Bayard Rustin, who I mentioned earlier, argued that civil disobedience at the Capitol would be a mistake because it would cost Democrats the election. It's funny how it's always comes up. SCLC board members opposed it as well. SNCC actually hesitated to commit resources to it, kind of from like an ultra-left perspective. The AFL-CIO's President George Meany, we can hiss again, okay, would not endorse the campaign because of his commitment to the Vietnam War. The FBI had actually created a program called Operation Pokem, P-O-C-A-M, not like poke them, Pokem, to undermine the campaigning, the campaign by actually intimidating recruits in Birmingham and throughout the South. You know, if you join this campaign, you'll lose your welfare, you'll get jailed, you know, things like that. It seemed like without the support from the labor movement and its tremendous resources, its financial power, its social power, without this support, the odds that King could pull off this new campaign for economic justice just seemed slim. So, as the Tet Offensive broke news, and while King struggled to garner support for the Poor People's Campaign, I want to shift gears a little bit and look at what's something that's happening in a very, very special place in the country, and that place is Memphis, Tennessee, where some great music has come, but also some great struggle. Memphis was becoming the watershed in phase two, in this phase two of the Civil Rights Movement. On February 12th, 1968, 1,300 sanitation workers, all of whom were black, would go on strike. Their struggle was the first of its kind since the death of civil rights unionism during the Red Scare. It was a labor battle led by black workers that actually ignited a social movement in Memphis. The sanitation strike was a materialization of King's vision for the Poor People's Campaign. King would become rejuvenated by it, try to lead it, and would unfortunately die doing so. In many ways, the sanitation strike was a long time in the making. And I'm going to go through a little history again. During the Depression and the war, Second World War, Memphis had an interracial labor movement. Black workers were leaders in famously organizing the Firestone factory workforce into Local 186 of the United Rubber Workers. The local would survive the Red Scare, but it was one of the few left-wing unions to have been able to. The Red Scare had silenced labor's call for black rights. The Red Scare would, in a sense, decouple the movement for labor rights and civil rights, making those fights proceed separately and thus each more weakly. I'm gonna throw a famous piece of law legislation out here because I think it's important to remember. The Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. Mm-hmm. Compelled union leaders to sign legal affidavits stating that they were not communists. So what's the link there between that and the fight for black rights? Well, this had the effect of uprooting any left-wing and anti-racist leaders and entire locals even. Taft-Hartley also allowed states to pass so-called right-to-work laws. Tennessee has been right to work for a very long time. Tennessee quickly passed legislation preventing unions from collecting fees from workers who did not join the union. So the result of all this was that unionization levels actually dropped to levels lower in the post-war period than they were during the war and depression. This was actually a setback. The end of the war industry also coupled with the mechanization of cotton farming drove up unemployment. I mean, I think this is becoming a shit show. The refusal of anti-communist labor leaders to fight racism meant that craft unions would survive and would prevent blacks from securing better jobs. So all of these factors that I just listed, all of them combined, made it harder for all workers to organize nationwide, Memphis included. So black workers from the countryside, right, mechanized out of their jobs, from the countryside would go to work, go look for work in the cities, and in Memphis, a lot of them went to Memphis, and many of them could only find work as a poorly paid sanitation worker. So that's the connection. So let me talk a little bit about sanitation work because it sucks, and especially under you know, Jim Crow and post, but really still Jim Crow. Sanitation work resembled slavery, straight up. Supervisors themselves had also come from the planter families, and so together with the city government, they disciplined workers as if they were slaves. Sanitation workers could be fired for talking back to a supervisor. They would not get paid on rainy days. when they couldn't work. They had to work in extremely unsafe conditions. Households were not required to bag garbage or take it to the curb. So sanitation workers were responsible for cleaning up the area and breaking their backs to haul that those trash cans to the truck. And imagine if it rains, it's just like it's heavier. It's very back-breaking work, all without gloves or work uniforms. They actually had to roll up in their own clothes. And there were no facilities provided in which to shower because, you know, who gives a fuck about them, right? So all of this, they did all of this for barely minimum wage, which was poverty wage. The city practiced extreme austerity, so sanitation workers used outdated and dangerous machines, and that's important to remember. For in the next few minutes. By the 1960s, some workers like T.O. Jones, a very important name in the struggle, black man, thought that things could change if they unionized. He actually believed this. Why would he believe this? Well, he was inspired by the moment. JFK's 1962 executive order allowed federal employees to unionize. King's Birmingham campaign of 1963, although not like a narrow labor struggle, it broke the back of Eugene Paul Conner's segregationism. And this inspired dozens of other cities to do the same. AFSCME, which the union, AFSCME, which was organizing government employees across the country, was, I think, the fastest growing union in the country in the 60s. And in 1968, in the same year that Memphis would go on strike, sanitation workers in New York City, which is where I'm from, went on strike and won. So why not Memphis? Why not Memphis? By as early as 1966, actually, T.O. Jones organized the majority of workers, of his co-workers, into AFSCME. Yet they failed to launch a strike that they had planned. Without allies from the black middle class and the national AFL-CIO, they were defeated before they even got started. The city was able to get a judge to issue an injunction. By the way, isn't an injunction like a fucked up, like random thing? Like, no, you can't. Like, that's just what an injunction is. And that's supposed to be like, we're supposed to respect that. Fuck that. Like King said, fuck the injunctions. But I'm not there yet. So this injunction stated that strikes against the public were illegal in Memphis. So this was actually set back the sanitation worker struggle until 2 years later, when unfortunately it had to come down to this. On February 1st, remember I asked you to remember about the dangerous outdated equipment. When on February 1st of 1968, two workers were crushed to death by the antiquated sanitation trucks. A real fucking tragedy. The murder of their two comrades, and this is what they called it. They called it murder, caused the sanitation workers to take their stand. They held the mayor, Mayor Loeb. Please remember that the name of that asshole, Mayor Loeb. Personally, they held him personally responsible for their deaths. Since years earlier, asshole Mayor Loeb had actually been the commissioner of public works and had refused to update the trucks. So Mayor Loeb, the asshole, who ran Memphis with this planter swagger, agreed actually to address the audience of these pissed off workers. And what he had to say to the strikers was frankly stupid. He said, "You're breaking the law, go back to work." Some of you are laughing, and upon this announcement, the audience erupted in laughter. They laughed at him. And Mayor Loeb had, Mayor Loeb, this is 1968, it's still like pseudo Jim Crow, and all these like black people are laughing at this, quasi-planter mayor. He had come to the meeting seeing himself as the father who needed to straighten out his children. Instead, men stood up to him and laughed in his face. To his surprise, there's actually footage of this, which is great. AFSCME organizer Jesse Epps recalled that this moment was, quote, the first time in the history of Loeb's life that he was no longer the master. There was an insurrection among the slaves. Yeah. Mayor Loeb would refuse to negotiate throughout the entire strike. He was stubborn. His stubbornness would exacerbate tensions throughout the following 2 months. It would cause the movement to gain sympathy and expand to challenge the system itself. And these violent confrontations would actually cause the Memphis struggle to become the center of national attention. First and foremost, I just want to say, sanitation workers on strike, they were on strike for principally union recognition and dues checkoff. Okay, it's true that they wanted higher wages, benefits, better working conditions. Who doesn't? But they realized from decades of repression, as both black people and as workers, that they needed to organize their power. It was about power. So the days that they could be threatened and abused in the job, that was over. Those days were over, they decided. And that required organization as a counterweight to the power of their bosses. The class struggle, these sanitation workers had decided, the class struggle will no longer be one-sided once their side was organized. So, compared to the failure that I talked about earlier of 1966, this time around, they slowly but surely would gain some allies. Not everyone in the black community was on board. Surprise, the black elite of Memphis opposed the strike for fear that their own employees would be inspired to unionize. It's something to keep in mind for today, because they're actually bigger and more entrenched. Liberals initially opposed it because they didn't want, and this was like a common thing that was parroted throughout this entire time across the entire South. Liberals initially opposed it because they didn't want what they saw as the racial peace that we have here lost. But solidarity came. Solidarity did come. Remember Local 186 of the rubber, United Rubber Workers that I mentioned earlier? They were still around, so they provided crucial support. They were an interracial local of 2,700 members, of which a third were black, and they offered their union hall for strike meetings. Civil rights clergy like Reverend James Lawson, who's a very important name in this, please remember him, as he's also so badass. YouTube him, he has great things to say. He organized, in solidarity, he organized boycotts of newspapers in downtown businesses, and of course, Martin Luther King Jr. would arrive on March 18th to galvanize the movement, raise support, and help lead it. I know I'm at 30, right? Okay. The moment leading up to King's arrival was marked by violent conflict. Not 2 weeks into the strike, on Friday, February 23rd, sanitation workers were beaten and maced by police, and again on March 5th. The workers decided then to confront the city council, which actually had three members who were black on it, decided to confront the city council about its inaction. And with a confidence justified by the mood of the moment, the Reverend Bell addressed the city council. This is a reverend. He addressed the city council. And he said this: "You call our sons off to be killed to protect your way of life." Talking about Vietnam, of course. "They come back here and don't have a place to live. It takes about $350,000 to kill a Vietnam soldier. We ask for the right to have a dues check off, and you say we have no right." That kind of garbage in the newspapers is not worth reading. I say, you men don't have any backbone, and you are all going to hell. This confidence showed that the repression of the past month had served only to escalate the struggle. That evening on March 5th, they occupied City Hall. 116 strikers and supporters were arrested, and the following day, seven union leaders were sentenced to 10 days in jail for allegedly violating this injunction of 1966. See, injunctions? By speaking at a mass meeting of strikers. That's what they were arrested for. So much for freedom of speech and the rights of assembly. Right? The next step in the escalation was to invite civil rights veteran Martin Luther King Jr. to Memphis. So, King arrives. He arrived on March 18th. I want you to remember that day too, because he gave a badass speech that day that I'll talk about. He arrived on March 18th to address the strikers. This certainly wasn't the first time that King actually would concern himself with labor issues. I want to go into that a little bit. As early as 1961, he addressed an AFL-CIO meeting and he said that labor and civil rights should actually work to become a single movement, like it had been. I don't know if he was thinking about this, but like it had been in the 30s and 40s to an extent. In 1964, King, I'm just going to talk about his labor cred here. In 1964, he joined the picket line at midnight of black women strikers of a pen and pencil factory in Atlanta. In 1966, the SCLC had actually called for the repeal of Taft-Hartley, right, knowing well that this anti-labor law, you know, just enhanced Jim Crow. That's all it did. Throughout his life, King, after all, had led a working class movement, even if it wasn't, you know, like a labor movement per se. The modern civil rights movement had not taken the form of a nationwide labor struggle, but with the defeat of Jim Crow, I think the movement had to move to new terrain, and here's where all these questions come up about how to proceed. So, King himself said what I just said, he said as much when he addressed the Memphis strikers on this day of March 18th. He said, with Selma and the voting rights bill, one era of our struggle came to a close and a new era came into being. Now, our struggle is for genuine equality, which means economic equality. For we know that it isn't enough to integrate lunch counters. What does it profit a man to be able to eat at an integrated lunch counter if he doesn't earn enough money to buy a hamburger and a cup of coffee? Then in his speech, King did something that no modern civil rights leader had done. He made this recommendation for how to escalate the struggle. He said, in a few days, he's like, also kind of like, it looks like he's like thinking from the top of his head here. He's like, you know what, like in a few days, you ought to get together and just have a general work stoppage in the city of Memphis. The audience of 17,000 strikers and supporters applauded, they shouted, they celebrated. He would be the first and maybe the only civil rights leader of this time to call on the working class to pursue what maybe he saw as the highest form of nonviolent civil disobedience, a general strike. So although this general strike never materialized, the fact that King raised the demand and that it was so enthusiastically welcomed signaled that a shift indeed had occurred in the civil rights movement. There was potential, yet there weren't the nationwide forces to realize it. King left Memphis the following day to continue recruiting and raising funds for the Poor People's Campaign, but this was a failure. No major labor leaders or black ministers responded to King's invitation to join the campaign. King was proposing a radical departure from the mainstream strategy. I mean, he was calling on ordinary workers to see the link between domestic poverty and Vietnam, to oppose democratic leaders when necessary, and to organize themselves to disrupt the system in workplaces and on the streets. In the Cold War era, labor leaders had relied on cooperation and backroom dealing rather than this rank and file confrontation that King is talking about to deliver the goods. The Red Scare had unfortunately removed the allies that King was searching for. King had, I'll be another like 5 or so minutes. King returned to Memphis on March 28th. To lead a citywide demonstration in Memphis. It was brutally repressed. In addition to tear gas and batons, tragically in revenge, police later that day, not even on the march, the police later that day like hunted and killed a teenager with a 12-gauge shotgun. His name was Larry Payne, because I'm going to say his name. His name was Larry Payne, and he was pleading for his life when the barrel of the 12-gauge was pressed against his stomach. The violence of the demonstration became nationwide news, yet the attention was not on the police, but on King. In the march, President Johnson demanded law and order, which we attribute to Nixon, but this is Mayor Loeb at the time, this is Lyndon B. Johnson. He demanded law and order and offered military assistance to the local authorities. Together with the media and other black leaders, they dismissed King. They called him a leader without a plan, said that he didn't know how to control a movement, and claimed therefore that a national march like the People's Campaign would be dangerous. Don't do this, King, don't do this. King was not very popular in the last year of his life. He was not, but because he was on our side. He didn't have allies. Even his staff in the SCLC raised their doubts. What they all failed to realize was that it's the police, and this rings true today, it's the police who hurt and murder people in ghetto rebellions, and that these rebellions in which mostly property is damaged or taken, the poor are expressing their unanswered cry for help, and that King's critics calls for waiting for elections and relying on politicians and passing laws, this had clearly overridden the work of actually organizing and mobilizing people to fight for themselves and win. So they're to blame, not King. Despite all this backlash, all this bullshit that King was getting, a testament to his commitment, he would come back to Memphis. And he did on April 3rd. Despite essentially being under martial law, Memphis strikers would bravely continue to picket under the soldiers' bayonets. I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures of the strikers with their I am a man signs, but they're bravely marching under those bayonets, the National Guard. If they could persevere, these strikers, King, so could King. He called for another march for the following week. A judge issued another fucking injunction against King, actually preventing him from, quote, from the injunction, quote, organizing or leading a parade or march in the city of Memphis.
Okay. When he was served the warrants at the Lorraine Hotel where he was staying, when he was served the warrants of the injunction, he laughed in their face. It's like a theme here, just like laughing at white power elites. It's great. The way King saw it, for the sake of the poor people's campaign and its goals, he had no choice but to remain among the strikers. He said, either the movement lives or dies in Memphis. So, getting toward the end here. When King landed on Memphis, in the Memphis airport, on April 3rd, he stayed in bed, actually, at the Lorraine Hotel. He had no plans to get out, to go out that evening. He was exhausted. He was running a fever. This was a very depressing year for King. His health was just not good, for reasons that I outlined earlier. Workers that night were showed up to the Mason Temple for another mass meeting. Throughout this time, there were like meetings and demonstrations and marches all the time. Memphis was just on fire with struggle. So this was like another one of those mass meetings. But they were disappointed that King wasn't there. They knew he was in the city, but he hadn't gone to the temple that night. Although he was never scheduled to, they just assumed. So around this time, in this evening, I want to talk about the weather a little bit. A tornado was sweeping through West Tennessee that night. And in Memphis, the winds were high and the downpour was torrential. King was phoned to come to the temple, actually, because he was so wanted. And despite the fever, despite the exhaustion, despite the weather, without any notes, as if God had wished it, right? He arrived to deliver one of his best, most inspiring, tragically prophetic, and of course his last speech. Who here has heard the Been to the Mountaintop speech? Okay, good. So you guys know how, like, if I get teary or whatever, it's like, it's because that speech was so good. And it's, King outperformed the thunder and the lightning of the storm that was echoing in the temple that night. He told the strikers that if God allowed him to choose a time in history to be in, he would decline being among the freed slaves in their journey from Egypt to the promised land, would decline being with Socrates and Plato in the Parthenon, would decline the Roman Empire, decline the Renaissance, decline the Protestant Reformation, decline seeing Abraham Lincoln issue the Emancipation Proclamation. No, he would ask for just a few years of the second half of the 20th century. And what King was saying here was that he would want to be in this moment of the second Reconstruction, among the people marching, being water cannoned, jailed, as long as he was with people like the Memphis strikers, standing up for what's right. These strikers were being told by an icon like King that he would rather be among them than the titans of Western philosophy. I'm a little over time. You guys mind if I just take a few more minutes? Thanks. King told the crowd that, he told the crowd on April 3rd in his last speech, in his I've Been to the Mountain speech, he told the crowd this: when the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. It's like so simple, but it's like, yeah. He told strike supporters that you may not be on strike, but either we go up together or we go down together. King made the case that indeed we could go up together. Oh, the speech is just so beautiful. He traces the victories of the student-led sit-ins of 1960 and 61, the determination of black people in the 1962 Albany campaign, although that somewhat failed. People standing up to the fire hoses in Birmingham in 1963, standing up to the police on horseback in Selma in 1965. Yes, if this could be done, then anything is possible, is what King was saying. King had reassured the crowd that he had gone to the mountaintop and that God had allowed him to see the promised land. It's real. It's there. He was saying that there is hope. Prophetically, he said he may not get to see it, but we as a people, quote, will get to the promised land, he says. And his last words to the crowd were, and I'm so happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And that was the last. That was his last speech. The following morning, King was in an unusually good mood. He had been suffering tremendous anxiety and depression since giving the Beyond Vietnam speech. And in the morning of April 4th, after... this story's fucking sad. In the morning of April 4th, after a friendly pillow fight with his staff, After requesting that a friend play his rendition of Precious Lord, he was on the balcony and his friend was down in the lot. He was like, I want you to play it real pretty. After 5 minutes of standing on the balcony of the Lorraine Hotel, a bullet tore through the jaw of one of the most greatest orators and activists in history. And photographer Ernest Withers took a photograph of King lying in his coffin, just like he had done for other civil rights martyrs, Emmett Till, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X. And so the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., if there was any silver lining, it produced an outpour of support for the Memphis strikers. They eventually won union recognition and dues checkoff, though their victory was far from perfect. These were hard times for the movement. And to paraphrase, I'm a Marxist, so I like to quote Marxists whenever I can. To paraphrase the Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, many civil rights leaders who were beginning to chart a different path to the promised land were in fact moving toward a different promised land, not one of milk and honey, but votes and dollars. Many settled for more acceptable positions of power in government in the Democratic Party. In 1977, after the first black mayor of Atlanta, Maynard Jackson, won the election with the support of Atlanta's own sanitation workers, he fired them all. Coupled with the end of the post-war boom and the new era of neoliberalism, clearly King's commitment to disruption from below was all the more important. But labor and former civil rights leaders had become integrated into the system and would not lead this confrontation that was necessary. I'll end in the next minute by saying this. The biggest challenge that King and the civil rights movement faced toward the end of his life was how to combine the fight against racism and poverty when these social ills were systemic and they were unwritten, right? They were the unwritten consequences of that capitalist exploitation. How the fuck do you fight that? That's hard. He could find support from a section of the capitalist class to end Jim Crow because segregation laws were, you know, ultimately not necessary for capitalism to function, hence capitalism today without Jim Crow. Still racist as shit. To fight capitalist exploitation, but without like an interracial labor movement, and an independent interracial working class party, which was on the agenda in the 30s and 40s, but the elite of the labor movement decided not to pursue it. Without all of this, this was hard to do, to fight capitalist racism. And it's still a question that we grapple with today. So let me truly end by just saying, and thank you for tolerating me going over. I think in this discussion, we can and we should talk about and debate strategy and tactics, but I think all of us in this room can agree that this promised land that King was talking about, it's still worth fighting for. And despite the rough terrain that we'll have to traverse, I'm confident that we can, especially being with all of you guys this weekend, makes the journey seem like it's going to be a bit easier. We're still, so to speak, wandering through the desert, if you guys know the Bible. And it will be a struggle, but King, like Moses, he gave his life to see the promised land, to give us the hope that it's there. And I'm just looking forward to talking with you all now and for the rest of the conference and after in the course of the struggle about how we as a people will get to the promised land. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.